song. Is it? Anyway. Hello, and welcome to Whose Song Is It Anyway? I'm Dr. Hayley Bosher, and for this special season of the podcast, focusing on women in the music industry, I'll be your host.
Hi, Michelle. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
It's a pleasure. It's been a long time coming, so I'm really, really glad to be speaking with you.
Honestly, I'm buzzing. Like, we have been trying to make that happen for a long time. So I'm like, yes, it's finally happening. So can you tell our listeners who you are and what you do in the music industry?
Okay, my name is Michelle Escoffery. I am a singer-songwriter. I've been involved in music practically all my life. I grew up in a singing family, the Escofferys. All my older sisters, my dad taught us all how to sing, and we were signed to Atlantic Records back in the early 90s. And then I was headhunted for another group called Truce that was signed also in the UK to an independent label. That's kind of where I cut my teeth as a songwriter and realized that I really love songwriting more than being a performer. And I was signed to EMI Music Publishing. And through that, I think I started kind of talking about music and talking about the songwriting process and started getting invited to universities to speak about music, which then led me to become a visiting lecturer, firstly at Westminster University and then at various others. So I've been involved in education from maybe about 15, 16 years, maybe. And I was the module leader for the master's program at Tile Yard for a few years. So taught on their commercial songwriting and production program. And more recently, I have been a member of the members council at PRS for Music since 2018 and became president of the members council in 2021.
Phew. I'm like, okay, can we all just take a second for this, like, oral history of this woman who's so incredible? I mean, wow, there's so much to unpick there, and I hope that we can dive a little bit into.
Yeah, man, let's unpack.
Let's unpack that. There is so much to unpack. So I feel like I'm going to go backwards and do it in chronological order, so okay. We'll forget things. So I love this story of the. You were saying about your dad taught you to sing and you started is like a family thing. That's so lovely. And how your journey there, and then how it's like evolved over into this like span of, and then you've got all your fingers in all the pies and doing all of the things. So take us back to that time we said when you, you were a singer, and what was your experience of the music industry then? Like, how was that for you?
I think that I was fortunate in a way, because I think I had a real cushion. I was really buffered a lot because I was the youngest in my family and there's quite an age gap. I feel like I got buffered quite a lot. So I would just kind of turn up and sing. So I didn't really get involved with some of the politics that were going on. For instance, when we signed to Atlantic Records, because we were signed in America, we weren't recognized in the UK as being an act. It's like, I know you're not signed by the UK. You're an American act. We're like, no, we're born and bred in the UK. What do you mean? So it's dealing with some of those politics. And I think as you get into it, you start to understand that there are so many different, I don't want to say levels, but I guess levels in a way. There's so many different levels to the industry. And there's so many different barriers or hoops to kind of jump over. And so for me, I think creatively, it was amazing because I got to be with producers and have that kind of open doorway in a way. Because I came in so young, there was already a network, there was already a community that my sisters had kind of developed. So I was able to plug straight into that. And go, oh, what do you think of this song? What do you think I should do here? And now when I look back at it older, I realize, oh, you were being mentored. You were being mentored from a very young age and kind of guided as to, well, don't do this, do that. Or, you know, totally ignore advice and go and do something. Go, oh, okay, that really didn't work. Okay, yeah, maybe I should have listened to that. So I think that experience for me of the industry was quite different to say other people that coming very cold and have to try and figure out, okay, who do I send my demo to? Who do I speak to? Things like that. I had a very different experience in that regard. But I think it's, you know, in my opinion, the music industry is very much about relationships, and it's about fostering and building and nurturing those relationships, because it all comes back around. You know, for instance, I was signed to Guy Moot back in, gosh, when was it? 1999 or 2000. And now, you know, seeing Guy at Warner's just running a thing, it's a whole different experience. And I speak to him in a very different way than I would have done, you know, when I was freshly signed as this new writer for EMI Music Publishing. But that community stays there, and it just evolves as time goes on. It evolves in different ways.
Yeah. And actually, I totally agree with you that the music industry is about relationships. And that's actually, for me, one of my favorite things about it. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
such a people industry. You meet
absolutely
so many wonderful people. And that's why it's so good to like network and grow that community. And at its best, those moments, it feels like a big family. Like, it sounds so cheesy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. But at its worst, if you're not in with certain people, then you're kind of in the wilderness, and it's trying to figure out, okay, how do I get to that person, or how do I manage to get into these kind of rooms? How do I get seen? How am I on the radar? And I think now, in some ways, it's slightly more challenging because, you know, I don't know, sometimes I feel like because of the internet and social media, sometimes it can be even more isolating. It's like a complete paradox, I guess. I don't know. It's like they're two opposite poles. You can reach the world, and you can have this global community, and things can be at your fingertips. But also, because there's so many people now and so much music out there, you can get lost as well. It's harder to be seen, it's harder to be heard. So I think that there's two things going on that need to be navigated at all times.
Yeah. And it's interesting what you said about feeling part of that community from early on, because one of the other interviews I did was with Vic Bain, and she's doing this research for her PhD interviewing women from the music industry. And I asked her, which I know is a question she would have asked all of the interviewees about, you know, what has been an enabler to success for women that face all these different barriers, whether it's sexuality, race, gender, you know, or economic circumstances. My question was like, was there a common theme, like personality wise? Like, because I was thinking, like, are we all women who are doing it? Like, are you all rebels that are just like, fuck this, I'm not playing your game? Do you know what I mean? I was like a personality trait. But, you know, one of the first things she said was community, network. Those actually are really important enablers that some people are fortunate to have, and some people they don't have and have to work to build that. But it's also quite empowering that that is something you can build, because it's not something that's totally out of your control. Like, although, as you say, it might be challenging for different reasons. So that's really interesting. But what's your answer to that? Like, what do you think it is about you that has led you to succeed in this industry?
Gosh, that's a big question. I think about that quite a lot. I think about the idea of imposter syndrome quite a lot. And in the last few years, I think that word has come up more and more and more. And I always think about that in terms of myself, because at first I'd be like, imposter syndrome. I don't know that I had imposter syndrome or have imposter syndrome. What does that mean? And for me, I guess it's that thing of, just ask, just go for it. Just, you know, I was very much driven. If I saw something and thought, I want to do that, I'm just going to go and do it. And I don't know if it's sometimes a negative trait, because I don't see no's. That's not in my vocabulary. It's like, okay, no's not yet. And actually, that's where I want to go. And if it's not a straight road, we're going to go around the bend and see how, if we can get to it another way. And for me, it's always been that way, that I've just thought, I want to do this thing, or I want to go over there, and I'm going to go over there. That's what I'm going to do. And it's, you know, somehow, you know, things work out, or you know, that barrier that was there starts to drop a little bit. Yeah, of course you get no's and of course you have barriers, but I think that if you really want to go for something, you will.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is like that, I love that, that like determination and kind of unwavering commitment to yourself, that you're like, I don't care what anybody else says, I've decided I'm going over there and I'll get there. Yeah. And you're just like a bump in the road if you're in my way.
Exactly. And the thing is that for me personally, my gender and my ethnicity should never ever be the deciding factor. And I've always maintained that. And in a lot of spaces, particularly in studios, you know, you could be the only female in the room. And in other spaces, you're the only Black woman in the room, you know, or you're the only person of color in the room. And that's always been a thing that I've, for me personally, it's like, okay, get comfortable with that. Get comfortable with the fact that you're that only person in the room. And how do we change that? How do we make that different? That's always been a thing for me. And it's something that I've always noticed, you know, it's changing now, but there, especially back, you know, in the 90s, there weren't a huge amount of women that were producers or that were engineers that you could be like, oh, wow, yeah, this person looks just like me. Okay, this is inspiring. It's just like, okay, I'm the only person here in the room. Am I going to be heard today? No. All right, then. How do I make myself heard? You know? So it's always been that. And maybe as well, being the youngest in the family, it's that thing of how do I make myself heard? You know, how am I taken seriously as the baby of the family? So I've always had that kind of, I'm going to push through. I'm going to make my voice heard. It's something that kind of travels with me. And I think it served me well. Thank God.
Yeah, it's like you've had very early training on like, okay, if I want to take up space, I have to actively
own it.
Do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love what you said about feeling comfortable being the only woman or the only person of color in a room. And this has come up in other conversations that people feel that lonely.
Yeah.
When they are
absolutely
not seeing people in the room that look like them. And so I was just wondering if, thinking of those people, what would you share with them about how did you become comfortable or work towards feeling more comfortable in that situation?
Yeah, I think for myself, it was about looking at my skills, looking at my skill set and looking at what I do rather than what I look like, or, you know, this is what I'm bringing to this table. This is what I'm bringing to this room. It has nothing to do with my gender, my sexual orientation, my sexuality, my ethnicity. It has everything to do with my capability and my skill set. And I was very, very clear on that. And I remain very clear on that. And I guess my remit always is, let's look at what they can do. You know, before we judge anything else, what are they capable of? And that's really the deciding factor for me. We don't go with something just because it's tick boxing. We don't go with something to fill a gap. We go with something because that skill is very apparent. And that's what I've worked really hard to do in terms of, even in terms of my songs, it's let's judge it by the quality of the song rather than who's behind the song. And because, you know, I ran the risk of being pigeonholed a lot early in my career because it was, oh, you're a Black girl, you must write R&B. Oh, you must write gospel. Oh, you must do this kind of music. And fighting that pigeonholing, literally, I was doing white labels. I was sending songs to A&Rs without my name on it, getting somebody else to vocal it because my voice is very distinctive. So it's like, okay, I don't want them to know I wrote this song. So let me get someone else to vocal it. Send it in anyway. And it's like, oh yeah, we love it. Yeah, I wrote that. So it was ways of kind of breaking out of that box. And I guess what I would say is get really clear on what it is that you offer, what it is that you bring to the table, and be really confident in that.
I love that. I think it also relates back to what you said about imposter syndrome, because that's probably good advice for imposter syndrome as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And knowing that, you know, we've grown up in a society that doesn't automatically make us feel like we have permission to be in the room and to take up space. Okay. But so it feels strange to have to like pep talk ourselves into doing that.
Yeah.
But that's not actually on us. is it? It's like we're unlearning what society has taught us, and therefore that's why it takes these kind of mindsets to overcome that, and why imposter syndrome is so common. And I mean, all of the women that I spoke to have mentioned that. So it's obviously something that's, which I think also helps, because it's like, you're not alone.
You're not alone.
Loads of us. And I always tell the story of, because people are like, you know, copyright is my area of expertise.
Yeah.
Got PhD on it, written books on it. And sometimes I revise my own work before I do an interview. And I'm like, what are you doing? I wrote this.
Yes.
And absolutely. It's just, you've got to laugh, haven't you? Because you're like, that's, but it's about being compassionate to yourself as well, not being hard on yourself. Like, why do I feel like this? Because that just makes it worse. And I think that's another theme that has come up. Like, the way you speak about yourself and your journey is very compassionate. I get the feeling that you're kind of friends with yourself. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is so radical. Like, lots of people struggle so much with that. And I think it's a journey. A journey I've been on, and it's not something people necessarily, well, some people may be lucky enough to just wake up and love themselves and feel worthy and that they can do things good. I mean, happy for you.
I agree with you. I do think it's a journey, and I think it's a constant journey as well. And the more that we're bombarded with, you know, oh, but you're not good at this, and oh, but this isn't great, it's like turn that on its head. You know, when we were performing, every show, my dad at the end of the show would critique and say, this was great, this was great, this was great, you need to improve that. So it was always, okay, I know that there's things that I need to improve, but I also know that there's things that I'm good at. And I think that we, especially as women, we need to flip that on its head, because we always discount ourselves. You know, I'm a trustee for PRS Foundation, and when we notice that women are not even putting themselves forward, women, you know, are discounting themselves because they're looking and going, oh, I don't hit all of the criteria. And it's like, well, you don't have to hit all of the criteria. Do you hit 50%? Do you hit 60%? Yes, you do. Okay, so then there's room for you to learn and improve, apply, you know. So actually getting ourselves to a place where we know that we've got things to learn, but everyone has things to learn. We all do. I don't think there's anybody that knows everything, you know? So being able to be in that space where it's like, okay, what are my skills? What am I good at? Okay, and then what could I expand on? Yeah, I can put myself forward for that. I think I could do that. And I think you touched on it earlier. It's also about communicating with each other. One thing that I've found really useful in the last couple of years is having a network of women to bounce ideas with, to, you know, maybe even complain to, and then realize, oh, we're all in the same boat. Everybody's experiencing this thing. Oh, right. I'm not by myself and I'm not going crazy. And that's been so empowering, because it's like, okay, what tips have you got? All right, well, I'll share my notes if you share yours. And just feeling like, actually, we can do this. Yeah, we can, for sure.
Totally. And I completely agree with you. Like, the feeling of growing community and knowledge exchange is so empowering.
So important.
I think secrecy in the music industry is a way to displace power. So just opening up and sharing, I'm going through this, or I got paid this much to do that, or I applied to this even though I only had 60% of the criteria, like you said. People are doing that. And there's loads of research that supports what you're saying in terms of men are more likely to apply for things they're less qualified for than women. Yeah. And I always keep that in my mind whenever I'm applying for something, because I'm like, all right, well, if I was a bloke, I would just apply for this and they would have the same CV as me. It's just that I'm a woman and I'm trained to apply when I've got 95 to 100% of the criteria. And that is actually not necessary. Exactly. So just, and it's terrifying, but go for it. And I found the more you do it, the less scary it becomes, obviously. And then, so I'm really glad you said that. I also do some work with Help Musicians, and they have the exact same statistics that they're really trying to encourage more women to apply. So if you're listening to this and you're a woman who makes music, check out these funds and foundations, because they are really keen to support women. And it's a two-way street because you've got to put yourself forward. Otherwise, if you don't put yourself out there, it's not gonna happen, is it?
Exactly. And that's you know, another thing, isn't it? It's visibility, because you do have so many women doing amazing things, but no one knows anything about them because they're not visible, you know, or they're not on people's radar. So it's also getting comfortable talking about what you do. And I speak to myself when I say that as well, because a lot of the time I just go, oh, I just do it. Oh no, I don't want to talk about that. Oh no, do I have to do this interview? But it's important. It's really important. And it's for other people to see and go, oh, they're doing that. I can do it. Let me try that, you know? And that's so key, so key. And there's been so many people that I've met, especially over the last few years. And it's like, what did you say you do? And then they reel all this stuff up and you're like, I didn't know you did that. Oh my God, that's amazing. And you're thinking, why don't you talk about this stuff? Where do I find this? How do I not know this stuff about you? So it is about being visible and just sharing with other people. And then you think about those people, you know, when you're networking and people know what you do, when you're now thinking, oh, who can I get to do this? They come to your mind, you know, and you can put people forward. I'm really a strong believer in, I'm a bit of a shouter. And when I say that, what I mean is, if I know somebody that's good at something, I will recommend them. I will shout about them. You need to go and check this person out because they're really, really, really good. And I think that that's really important, to be able to shout about each other and say, check this person out, or go and meet with that person, because you know what, their view on this is really unique. Check out this engineer, check out this data analyst, because they're so thorough. Do you know what I mean? It's really important to shout about each other and to kind of raise our level together, I think.
Totally. Like, I'm the exact same. I think cheerleading each other is so, and I get so much joy from it myself. It's almost like a selfish good deed, because it's so lovely to be like, check out this person, they're amazing. And then especially if it leads to something and you see
something
and that person, you're like, oh my God, these things happen and you just feel like that's the kind of world I want to live in, where we are cheering each other on, not putting each other down. And so that's all, you know, everything you just said, completely agree. Okay, so let's speed up to the sort of more recent era of your legacy, I'm going to call it. How do you think that the challenges faced by women and women of colour in particular, because obviously the statistics show, not that we need statistics, we know, there's more barriers, the more baggage people can carry. So do you think there's been a change over time? And how has that been in your experience over, like sort of looking back overall?
Oh, that's a juicy one. I definitely feel that there have been some changes. There are definitely more Black women in space, which is fantastic. It's great to see. I might be a little bit controversial, but the buzzword of diversity sometimes really annoys me, bothers me, just from the mere fact that diversity is so broad and so vast, and it is so many things. You know, for me, when I talk about diversity, I talk about it on every level, whether that is where you were educated, where you were born, how you grew up, what genre of music you do, you know, whether you have what people see as a disability or not. All these things feed into diversity. It's not just one thing, you know, it's not just ethnicity and it's not just gender. So that kind of annoys me a little bit when we start to talk about diversity and it's like just one thing, or it gets kind of watered down in a way, because it's like, well, we have to include absolutely everyone. Yeah, but there are some people that are at the bottom of the rung. You know, there are some people that really don't get much help at all. And what are we doing about those groups of people? So from that point of view, that's why I say it's a bit of a buzzword at the moment. And it's like, well, I rather look at it as inclusion. How do we include everyone into the conversation? How do we include everyone in terms of how we are working as organizations, as businesses, as creatives, how do we become a lot more inclusive rather than, you know, diversity and recognizing our differences? It's like, okay, yeah, but how do we include people? So that's kind of where I'm at with it in terms of what that looks like, particularly in PRS, in our organization. It's okay, how do we become more inclusive? And what does that look like? Is that a change in language? Do we communicate with creatives differently than we communicate, say, with executives? And what does that language look like? You know, and really, really digging into those things. As Black women in the space, yes, we are the last people to be thought about. You know, when we go for things, it's like, oh, well, are you professional? Oh, well, your hair's curly. It's not really a professional look. Things like that. It grows out of my scalp, of course. What's your problem? You know, things like that. And also this kind of presumption that you're inexperienced. You know, when I decided to go for president, it was really interesting, the conversations, because it was like, oh no, maybe you don't have enough experience to do that kind of role. And it's like, okay, I've been in the industry like 30 years. How much more experience do I need? I've been writing songs for most of my life. If I can't speak to a membership of music creators, songwriters and composers and people that I've been in rooms with, I know that journey, who can? You know, what does that experience actually look like? So it's all, yeah, it's all very interesting. I think that it's great to see so many people of color in the space. What I'm concerned with is it performative? And is it tokenistic? Is it, oh God, we have to do this now to tick a box. We have to, we've got this charter to complete and it has to be done. Rather than, as I said before, we're looking at this because of your skill set. You're really great at your job. And actually, yes, we are completely up for having more inclusion and having a wider set of voices that influence our businesses and make it more productive, make it more, what's the word I'm looking for? More exciting and more reflective of the society that we actually really do live in. I think that that's where I'm very conscious of, okay, but why are we making this decision? What, are we ticking a box or are we actually doing this to make real change? And real change is what I'm really interested in.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I don't know if that was controversial, but thank you for, we're here for it. I'm here for the controversy, to hear people's different views. And what you're saying is so important. And I think, so I'm really glad you shared that. And it's a difficult one, isn't it? For people who are like, we talked about this on one of the other episodes about the difference between equity and equality.
Exactly.
It's like you can be motivated to, like you said, tick the boxes and have, say, like you're looking at who you employ and you want to be more inclusive. Well, I love the way you use the language because I would completely agree with you that, like, for some reason, for me, diversity and diversify, it's like, it's a sounds, I don't know, I just, the connotations of that is like, hire a disabled person, hire a Black person,
exactly.
Go home and have lunch.
Yep.
And it's like, but there's so much research that shows that that doesn't even, there's no longevity to that.
Yep.
You're just slapping a plaster on the problem. It's going to get you nowhere.
Yeah.
In the end, you will still have discriminatory culture in your employment or in, and in the world.
Continue.
Instead, what you need to do is that deep work. And that's why I love what you said about inclusion, because the inclusivity and inclusion for me, it just feels like such more of a doing word.
It's like
we're going to actively make this space feel inclusive and welcoming for everyone.
Yeah.
Different needs and all different experiences in life.
Yeah.
I think it's really powerful what you said.
And also, you know, for somebody that comes from a different community, a different background, you also question, why am I being asked to do this? Why am I being employed? Why all of a sudden it's like, oh, you're the popular kid? It's like, am I being hired on my merit and my and the work that I can do? Or am I being hired to tick a box? You know? And no one's silly. No one, we know the difference, you know? It's that thing where you've got no job description. It's like, oh no, we just want you, come and do what you do. What does that mean? You know, things like that. It's like, actually, no, we'd like a job description and we want KPIs just like everyone else. And we want to know that we're doing a great job. So but those are the things that I think that we need to be more aware of and really look at raising the bar together. You know, if we're talking about progress and progression, make sure that we are doing that in the right way. And we're doing it so that, like you said, it has longevity. So that in 5 years' time, when there are 30%, you know, of women in a company, or there's more ethnicity in the company, but they're the ones that are shining. They're the ones that have come in with the bright ideas. They're the ones that are taking it way over the edge because they're brilliant, you know?
Yeah, and given equal kind of support and opportunity, because it's so clear that, like you said, people can just, oh yeah, come and work here and I don't know, answer the phone or something. And then in 5 years' time, that person's not been promoted, not been given a pay rise. It's not helping the pay gap. Yep. It's not helping the culture of the organization.
It's not helping progression, you know, and we all want to progress and we all should progress.
Yeah. So if someone is listening to this and they're like, I really thought I was, because sometimes I think people, you know, have a lot of work to do and some people have good intentions, but they don't know how. And I think those are, for me, that's my crowd, because I'm like, if you're willing and you're up for it, you just like feel a bit lost and nervous and scared. People ask me things about like, you know, how do I do that? Because I want to be supportive, but I also don't want to come across like I'm being performative, which is like a hard line to sort of walk on. But those are the people we can work with because they're willing.
Yeah.
So thinking of those people listening who want to do better, but maybe don't know how.
Yeah.
What would you say to them about doing this work and sort of where to get started?
I would say that educate yourself. Do not put the burden back on the particular group to educate you. There are so many things out there, so many articles, books, interviews, podcasts, all kinds of things, policy. Educate yourself, get some kind of level of understanding before kind of asking those basic questions, because that's annoying, quite frankly. It's like, okay, I want to help you, but you have to educate me. No, educate yourself and then we can move forward. So I would say educate. And also one of the things that I would say as well is, again, communication. Don't know what you don't know. And I think that that works both ways. I think that a lot of times we have perceptions about what a group are doing or not doing. And it's false, you know, it's completely false. And that, like I said, that works both ways. So I think communication, some conversations are uncomfortable, but that's okay. It's all right to have uncomfortable conversations if you are going to get to a different level of awareness, a different level of understanding. And some of those conversations can be really, really simple. You know, I've had conversations with, you know, friends that are Asian and hadn't understood certain nuances and gone, oh, I didn't realize that happened in your culture. Okay, I'm aware of that now, you know. Or speaking with somebody that has a perception, I remember having a conversation with a colleague and talking about the stresses of when you say that Black women are aggressive or Black people are aggressive, they get into the office and, oh, but they're a little bit aggressive. And it's like, well, actually, first of all, we communicate very differently to you. We're very straight and we're very expressive and animated. That can come across to you as aggression, but it's not. Secondly, if I'm coming into the office, I can experience so many microaggressions before I even get to work. Someone doesn't want to sit next to me. Someone speaks to me in a horrible way. All these things can happen. Or I have out and out some kind of racial abuse and I'm sworn at and abused before I even get to work. So when I've got to work, I'm already stressed. So when you're asking me questions that make no sense in my head, I might answer in a narky way. Do you know what I mean? But it might not have anything to do with you in that way. So it's those things about having those open conversations about what triggers you. How do you navigate this stuff? You know, when I tell my friends sometimes things that happen on the train, even yesterday coming home, sitting on the train. The train is full. It's full to the brim, but no one will sit next to me. And it's like, those are the aggressions that we're talking about, you know, and it's just like, wow, this is really still happening. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And some people might say, oh, no, 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 that's not true. It doesn't happen. Yes, it does. It happens every day, all the time. And we deal with it. That's traumatic. So being able to be open to have conversations and to communicate with each other breaks down barriers better than anything else I know, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
It's like, what are we going to do about it? You know, it's great to have those conversations, but then we say, what are we going to do about it?
Yeah. So having that kind of solution focused mind. But like you said, without that communication in the first place, you're going to get nowhere.
You wouldn't know that that person is stressed. It doesn't have anything to do with you. You know, somebody said to me the other day, oh, I was going to work and somebody was being really horrible to them and they spat at them, you know, and it's like, ugh. But they now have to carry that into work and clean up and just pretend like everything's fine. Everything is not fine, you know, and it's being able to have that space to have those kind of conversations and express yourself. At PRS, we have affinity groups, you know, ethnicity, disability, religion, gender. There's loads of groups that we have that they can discuss these things and talk about, all right, how do we move forward? What do we need to implement that makes it easier for us to be in this workspace together, working together and understanding each other? And I think that's, I think it's really progressive and I think it's really important as well.
Totally. I'd really like you to talk a bit more about that, because what I love about it is what you're saying is we have to communicate, but then we have to facilitate that communication, because you have to feel you're in a safe space where you can share this horrible thing that happened to you and you're not going to be judged. And you're also not going to be invalidated, like you just said, oh, it doesn't happen, because that person hasn't experienced it. So you don't want to share with them. You want to share with someone who's going to be like, mate, that's fucking sucks. And I believe you instantly because I've had similar experiences and I know this is how the world works. So creating those safe spaces is so important for even to enable people to be vulnerable and feel safe to share. And also to create for the, it's a two-way thing, isn't it? You've got to feel safe enough that you can share and be vulnerable. And then you want people to be open and listen to you without invalidating, without, you know, being able to communicate with you in a way that they can, do you want me to help you fix this, or do you want me to just listen?
Exactly.
Like, what are we doing here?
Exactly.
Can you tell us a bit more about the groups?
Affinity groups.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the affinity groups were set up maybe about I want to say about a year or a year and a half ago. Maybe, I don't know. I'm not sure. I might be saying wrong. But I've been aware of them probably for about a year and a half. And basically exactly that, creating safe spaces. So one of the things that we looked at, particularly in lockdown, was the fact that some groups are more isolated than others. And how do we provide support for those groups in a constructive way, you know, and also that it's not just an echo chamber. Because, you know, you have these groups, sometimes you have focus groups and it's just like, okay, but you're just talking amongst yourselves and nothing actually really happens. So for us, it was really important not to have an echo chamber and actually make them task-based, make them solution-based. And if there are concerns with certain groups within our organization, that we can address them. And we have channels to be able to do that. So we have affinity groups that are linked to our equality, diversity, and inclusion programs. We have imperatives. We have tasks that it's like, okay, what do we need to improve? For instance, last year, we decided we don't want to talk about the struggle for Black History Month. How do we make it more positive? How do we make it more progressive? So we had Akala come and speak about the history of Black Britain. And that was so amazing, so informative. I learned so much stuff on that day. And then we also had the round table where we were discussing as executives, how do we work as a community within the industry? And what needs to be changing, again, looking at the future and looking at solutions of things that we can do to create change, sustainable change. So the affinity groups, that's what they're about. It's about having a safe space, being able to have your voice heard, but also integrating that back into our organization and making sure that everybody kind of respects each other. So For instance, we have a prayer room at our offices, at our hub. We also have a space for new mothers that are expressing, because that's some of the things that came out of those groups. You know what? We want to come into the office, but we can't because we're still breastfeeding, but we want to. So how do we facilitate being able to allow for them to come into work, but, you know, every couple of hours, they got to do that thing. You know what I mean? So it's things like that. It's just dealing with things on a very human level. How can we support you to do your job well and to enjoy being in this space?
Yeah, I love it. I really hope that inspires other people who are in a position to be able to create those kind of spaces for people. Take that on board, because yeah, I think it's amazing. And it's just like you said, it's everything is a journey and it's a learning. Like you said, you learn from that talk, and I feel like I'm learning all of the time. But I'm an academic. I'm a proactive learner on every possible level you can imagine, because I literally love it.
Yeah.
But for me, it's things like, so for instance, like I'm on the spectrum. So I had to learn like active listening. And when I was like, oh my God, before this, people must have thought I was so f-ing rude. And I honestly wasn't doing it on purpose. Like, apologies to anyone ever. But like, it's something that I learned to do, because I realized that I wasn't being, you know, I wasn't coming across as someone who was like caring and nurturing those conversations in that moment. So it's like you said, it's about educating yourself, acknowledging you're on a learning journey and what you need to learn and work on and all of this stuff.
Yeah. And also, like, for us as an organization at PRS, what we need to learn. So, you know, in terms of neuroexpansiveness, it's like, okay, what do we need to learn about that? Some people work better with, like we were discussing this yesterday in terms of dyslexia, and, you know, that some people work better with different colors. They can make sense of information when you put it in a different color. And those are things that we're really, really aware of. With the PRS PPL joint venture in Leicester, I went up there last year and I was blown away by the amount of neuroexpansive employees that we had. And how they work differently. There was a lady I spoke to, and she was like, you know, my attention span's really short. So they've given me this kind of work to do, which is focus. It's very short. I can get it done. And then I move on to something else. And I was like, wow, I wouldn't even have thought of that, you know? But it's those kind of inclusive, really conscious decisions. We're going to train differently. We understand that. If this person is behaving in this kind of way, you know what? Maybe we should get them tested, because maybe they don't even know. Do you know what I mean? And that's been happening so much. So many creatives have been saying, oh my God, I got tested at like 35 and all of a sudden my whole world has opened up because I just thought something was wrong with me. Mm-hmm. But actually, I'm neurodivergent, or I like to say neuroexpansive, you know, because I just think we all have different gifts and we all have different abilities. It's just expressed in different ways. That's how I see it. And I just think once we start really celebrating that and looking at that in that positive way, oh my gosh. I mean, we already see it. We already know that there's companies that really use neuroexpansive people for, say, data or figuring out certain things, because their brains are so brilliant. So, and in creativity, it's exactly the same. You're thinking, oh my God, you're a genius. You play like 11 instruments. How did you do that? All those things, I just think that we have to keep training ourselves to become more aware of each other and more aware of ourselves as well.
Yeah, I love it. And I love what you've just said about neuroexpansive. And this is a perfect example, because I'm like, I'm going to use that now. So I've just learned, and I am neurodivergent. Like, I've been using
the insinuation that it comes, you're away from the norm.
Exactly how I pictured it. It was like, you're setting a standard of like, this is typical, and then you're non-typical. So it's like you're out. But the joke is as well, especially in the music industry, like you said, it's not a coincidence that
it's typical.
Exactly. We are all, like you said, neuroexpansive. And I just love it that it links so well with the kind of inclusivity language, because what you're saying is we're all different and we all have different ways to meet a need. It's not like there's a group. Who are those neurotypical people? I don't know them. I don't hang out with anyone I would call neurotypical. So it's like, you're not different to the norm. There is no norm.
Yeah, exactly.
We're all different.
Exactly.
Love it. So thank you. I'm going to adopt that term from you. Brilliant. Okay, so you have answered this. I'm going to ask you the question that I've asked everybody, and you've touched on lots of answers, but if you want to just, so feel free to repeat yourself or to build on what you've said, just for a concise kind of bringing everything together answer.
Yeah.
So what do you think that the music industry can do to become a more inclusive place?
I truly believe that we need to stop looking for what's normal and what is, oh, well, this is how we've always done it, so we're just going to keep doing it that way. Life is always changing. We are always changing as human beings. Our everything is always changing. And we've just been through this experience that's shown us on every level how much things can change and can be out of our control. So I think that it's really about evolution and about embracing evolution and embracing that, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it was vinyl. You know, now we're streaming, but we have evolved. The music industry has evolved. So mindsets need to evolve as well. And I think that that's really important to be, yeah, embracing of different mindsets and the fact that we do things differently and we will do things differently. I love working with young people and developing young talent because of that, because I'm just always buzzing afterwards thinking, oh my God, I didn't even think of doing that. Oh, that shortcut, I'm going to do that. Or, oh, you write with that? Oh, you use that method. I never even heard of that method. Okay, let me figure that out, you know? And it keeps you fresh. It keeps you excited. It keeps you engaged. Otherwise, you stagnate and you just do what you do and it's old. You know, I have a 21-year-old daughter and sometimes I'm showing her things and she's like, I'm not being funny, Mum, but you're old. So you're like, oh, there's me thinking I was being cool. Fine, you know? So I think that it's being open to evolution. It's being open to change. It's being open to not just looking for the next big thing, but looking for the next evolution. I think that that's that for me. And in order to do that, you have to bring in other voices. You have to bring in other people that have traveled different roads. You have to bring in different backgrounds because they're going to look at it differently. Look, you know, embracing different perspectives. I think that's how the music industry is going to remain exciting and remain progressive and cutting edge.
Amazing. Thank you so much. That was a brilliant answer. And obviously, I completely agree with you. It's just, like you said, that what you're talking about, it gets me excited. I feel the energy when you're saying that. And I'm like, yeah, because that is progression in a way that is so nourishing and will help the music industry flourish. Like, this is all good.
Yeah.
Sticking, like, I completely agree with you. There's nothing more stagnant than this is the, we do things this way because this is the way things
this
have
is just
always
how we've done it. Yeah.
Been done. Yeah. And that's so unproductive. I read about a story that highlights this point once where this woman said she cuts the top off the turkey every time she makes the turkey at Thanksgiving. And her friend comes around for dinner and she's like, why do you cut the top off the turkey? And she's like, oh, I don't know. That's how my mum did it. So she calls her mum and she's like, Mum, why do you cut the top off your turkey? It's like, oh, because when I was little, we had a really small oven. And so my mum used to cut the top off her turkey so it could fit in the oven.
Yeah.
And it was like three generations of women later, they're still cutting the top off the turkey, but they haven't thought about why they're doing that. And that's just like a perfect analogy for like not doing things the way that they've always been done, because there probably was a reason that's not relevant anymore.
Exactly.
You've got to look at things fresh, like you said. So that was an amazing answer. Thank you. Really appreciate that. So is there anything else that you feel that you wanted to share that we haven't touched on or you wanted to talk about that we haven't mentioned yet?
Yes, there is. I've been working on an initiative that I'm developing called Pause, and it is for melanated women within the industry or within creative industries, creating a safe space for them to come and talk and express themselves, create a network, share, be supported. I'm not sure if you know, but I'm very much into wellness. I'm a qualified wellness consultant. And my kind of, I guess my speciality in terms of that is about joy and about working through horrible situations in life by tapping into your joy. So I've been working on maybe about a year now, this network called Pause. We're on Instagram, if I can shamelessly plug it. It's a private group, but it's private in order to protect that kind of safety of that circle. So it's pause.theinnercircle. So we have events where we do wellness events. We work on the tools of what you need in order to kind of be in this space and be doing this work and not get burnt out and exhausted and just want to give up. So yeah, so that's what I've been working on for the last year or so. And it's been really good, really, really good.
Sounds amazing. And I have to say, I didn't know the details of that project, but you know, earlier when I was like, I'm getting this compassion vibe from you and I'm getting this positive energy from you, so like it clearly works.
Thank you.
Because thank like you. I said, it's doing this work and being in the industry, you could so easily get deterred or burnt out, or
absolutely, you
know, like we were saying, it's work to undo the learning, it's work to face, like when you're telling me the story about just getting on the train, and it's like that's energy sapping shit you have to deal with.
Yeah.
And so it's so lovely to hear about this kind of countering. Yeah.
Exactly. And what I've learned is that, you know, our baseline birthright is joy. And most of the time when we're going through things, there are always still moments of joy, you know, and it's expanding that joy and being more in that space than the exhausted, stressed, burnt out space. And how do we find coping mechanisms, but not just coping mechanisms, ways of being different, ways of actually dealing with it completely differently. So for me in the last year, I've been working a lot on my boundaries and being okay with saying, no, I'm not going to do that. That doesn't work for me. So my three questions at the moment is, does it light me up? Does it give me joy? And is it going to be for the greater good? And if it's yes to all of those things, it's a yes. But if it's no to more than one of those things, then it's a no.
I love it. That is so great. And I hope people also take that on board, because we feel like, I definitely think this for myself, and I could definitely take that on board. And for the other women that I spoke to on the podcast, especially, like, we feel like we have to say yes to everything.
And you don't. No is a complete sentence. And it's like, if I'm not going to feel any joy from it, why am I doing it?
Yeah. And I think it's giving yourself, it comes back to your relationship with yourself. Like you said, you deserve joy. Because I think for me, where I struggle is the underneath of that, which is like, you have to first feel worthy that you can give that to yourself. And that's the whole thing.
Yeah.
But then that's why we go back to the birthright.
Yeah.
Because when you're born, you get all the joy in the world. You know, you're cute. Everybody loves you. That's your birthright. That's the baseline. So it's tapping into that. What makes me feel good? What makes me feel happy? And it could just be one thing. It could be, you know, that. So I'm cutting down on, like, sounds really mad, but I'm cutting down on like sugar and tea and stuff like that. So my one thing is I'll have one cup of tea a day. And that's when I can sit down and have my tea. And it's great. And no one disturbs me. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, what are the things that make you feel good? And if you do one a day and then build that up, you will start to feel more connected to yourself. The problem is, as well as women, is that because we give and give and give and give, we don't think about, we're the last person to think about, oh, what do I need? What makes me happy? You know, is it walking for 10 minutes, going for a 10 minute walk? Is it having a bath? Is it speaking to your friend on the phone and laughing about anything? Do you know what I mean? Like, what is it? And that sense of inquiry is really important, and we deserve it. And we can't be productive. We can't be out there constantly giving at a top level if we are not giving to ourselves. It's not possible.
So true. It's like that age old saying, you can't pour from an empty cup.
Exactly. Exactly.
So true. And I think what you said is really, really important about the inquiry, self-inquiry, because some people, if you're used to, like you said, trying to be everything for everyone and trying to do everything all of the time, You might not even know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
And so the inquiry part's really important. And actually, that's a really fun journey to go on.
Yeah.
Figuring out what brings you joy.
Yes.
And it changes, you know, over time, it changes as well. Sometimes it literally could just be, I just need some quiet time. And other times it might be, I need to travel, or you know what? I haven't been dancing for ages. I want to just go and dance and enjoy that. Do you know what I mean? So it changes over time as well. And that's okay too.
Yeah. And no, it's about knowing yourself, isn't it? Because I was just thinking of times when, like, I've said to a friend, like, yeah, we're going dancing, and they're a bit begrudging. And I'm like, you have to know the person well enough to know when you can push, when you let them go. Yeah. And I'm like pushed. And then the next day they're like, oh, thank you, because I forgot how much I loved that. And I was like, it's okay, because I remembered for you.
And that's so cool. That happened to me the other day. I was invited to an album launch, and I was a little bit like, this is, you know, because it's work for me. I'm going there in a capacity, you know, as president, and, you know, it's work. But I timed it, and I was like, I'm going to go just before they come on stage. And then I'm going to stay for like 40 minutes, make sure my face is seen, and then I'm going to leave. That was my plan. And then I went, and then it was great. And they played music, and I ended up staying like literally till they turned the lights on. And I just thought, oh my God, that was so much fun. I forgot what it feels like to dance, what it feels like to be in that kind of space. And I loved it. And I was like, I think I need to do that more often. I need to find some little club nights or parties or something where I can dance, not in my front room. Do you know what I mean? And we have to remind ourselves sometimes of those things. We're very responsible. And obviously, especially with this whole living crisis, everybody's stressed, but we have to have outlets.
Totally. Well, amazing. Thank you so much. And we'll definitely put all the links to everything that you've mentioned, so people can find out more. Please check out the bio of the podcast, because we will put links to everything you can find and follow and get involved. So my last question, which I've asked everyone on this season, is for you to please share a favorite, I'm saying female music maker, but obviously in the spirit of inclusivity, it doesn't actually have to be someone who identifies as female. But and same with music maker, can be somebody's involved in any part of the process of making music happen.
Okay.
And if you don't have to stick to one, but if you can think of someone who you would consider like your favorite all time ever, like, and how maybe somebody that's inspired you, and then also somebody like maybe more kind of recent, who's sort of come into your life and you're like really loving and appreciating them.
Ooh, okay. All right. So inspired, definitely without doubt, would have to be Missy Elliott. Again, because she's so innovative, I just think she's amazing. She's recreated her sound herself so many times. I love her style of songwriting, how she uses harmony, and the fact that she sings, she raps, she produces, she does it all. And I just find her a complete inspiration. So I think Missy Elliott for sure. Alanis Morissette. I was very inspired by Alanis when I was kind of penning a lot, because of her narrative and her conversational way of writing, and the fact that she didn't rhyme words. That just blew my mind. And just the power behind her voice. I found her amazing. Joan Armatrading, who's still obviously with us and just doing great things. And I love the fact that she's still kind of here and doing her stuff. Joni Mitchell as well. You can't mention without mentioning Joni Mitchell. I mean, woo, amazing. And then the newer, let me think. You know what? I'm going to have to go with Camille Purcell. I met Camille, maybe 2012 or so. I'm shy. Going into the studios in Kilburn and kind of really honing her craft, learning an instrument, etc., and just saying, oh, I really want to do music. I really want to be a songwriter. And then a couple of years later, it was like Saturdays blowing up. She's this mega songwriter. You're thinking, huh? Oh my God. It's just been an absolute joy watching her journey and watching how involved in the whole process that she is in terms of vocal production, arrangement, and maybe because I do vocal production and arrangement, it's like, oh my God, the vocals, you're thinking about all the details. So yeah, that really excites me. And there's loads, there's so many, but I'll stick to those ones.
These are all great answers. And I'm so glad actually, because sometimes people are basically, for people listening, I've made a playlist. So everybody's answers have gone into a playlist. It's available on Spotify and Apple, so you can find them. And I just want it to be like, let's stick on this playlist that's like celebrating these incredible women.
Yeah,
in music and have a dance. So we've got some great ones to add to the list. Thank you. I'm also, if you don't mind, going to ask you a bonus question, because you just made me think of it, because you were talking about your own work. So what's your favorite song that you've ever worked on?
Oh God, that's hard.
And I've really put you on the spot here. Sorry, I wasn't really planning to ask you that, but now I'm like genuinely curious.
I don't know if I've got a favorite song. I have to say I loved doing Just a Little. It wasn't for Liberty X in mind at all. We were actually pitching for Tom Jones. So when you listen to it again, listen to it with that in mind.
Okay.
We were actually pitching for Tom Jones. And it was like, okay, what would an older man say, you know, about a younger woman? It's like, you work it a little bit. You've got this thing, but you don't even know what you've got. Do you know what I mean? It was more from that mindset when we wrote the song. And then it was put on hold by Anastasia. And then... Liberty X's A&R came in. And I think the reason why I'll say it's one of my favorites is because of the whole process. So we wrote that song. I was heavily pregnant. It was the last song I wrote before I gave birth. And then they wanted it to be their priority song. And it was like, it has to be recorded within this time frame. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm having a baby. I can't be doing all of this. And they came to my house literally 5 days after I gave birth. They auditioned the song and it was like, yeah, I think we could sing it, but I really want to vocal produce it. We went to the studio, I think it was 5 or 10 days after that. I went with my mum in tow, Moses basket, you know, feeding every 2 hours, recorded their vocals. And literally by March, it was out and it went straight in at number one. So that was one of my favorite processes. And they are such a lovely group, you know, personality wise, and they worked really hard in the studio to get the vocal and kind of get the vibe, catch the vibe of the song. And they kept it really authentic in terms of how we wanted the song to sound. So I think that was really my favorite process. And can I add just one more?
Yeah, please.
The other one would have been, and it's because I was totally fangirling, was Tina Turner. You know, when she decided to do one of my songs for her Greatest Hits album, and I was like, what? And it was just that thing of, I love the song, I want to keep you on the BBs. It was like, me? It was great. And she did it in one take. She raised it by, I think, a tone, sang it in one take and was out. I didn't even get to see her. I got there and I was like, oh, she's gone. She just did it in one take. I was like, what? Yeah, so that was another one. It was like, yeah, I've arrived. Tina Turner has sang a song of mine.
Talk about setting the bar high.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, thank you for sharing those extra questions. And also, do you know what's really funny? Like that, the Just a Little song, so catchy and memorable. I haven't heard it for a long time. And while I'm listening to you, I'm just like, just a little. Like it's in my head because it's so catchy. It's such a great song.
It was just good vibes. It was just, you know, a positive vibe. And it's really nice because the people that I wrote that song with, they're great friends of mine and they're brothers. So it's kind of like this family connection. And we were talking the other day to a group of people and saying, the songwriting element was the last thing. We'd go to the studio and we'd talk and laugh and eat cake and chat shit all day. And then be like, oh shit, we've got to write a song. We've got like 2 hours, let's do it. And it would always be that good vibe. So I think the reason why that song's done so well is because you can actually feel that kind of good energy.
Totally, it really comes through. I love that. Well, thank you so much, Michelle. It's honestly been a pleasure. And
wonderful speaking.
I could ask you questions for like the rest of the day because there's so much that we could talk about. But I really appreciate your time and sharing today. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. And I love speaking with you. It's been great. And it's it's been really good. Thank you.
Lovely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And if you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, and subscribe.